So this is the outline for the talk. We're going to discuss, it's an introduction, actually, some of the material that Michael Rotz just discussed, obifold guts versus string obifolds, slight review, brief review, and then we'll discuss work that's in progress, discrete flavor symmetries coming from the heterotic string obifold construction. So let's go to the first part. The phenomenological guidelines which led us to this analysis was, one, we wanted to preserve gauge coupling unification. Two, we wanted to preserve the fact that low energy supersymmetry may protect why the weak scale is so much smaller than the gut scale. With gauge coupling unification, it's also nice the fact that quarks and leptons fit in the 16-dimensional representation of SO10, so we want to preserve that. The Higgs fits in a 10-dimensional representation, so it's nice to keep that. I, per se, would like to preserve gut relations, particular for the third family of Yukawa couplings, because I think that gives you nice predictions. And also, you get a natural seesaw scale of order of the gut scale when you do, if you have the seesaw mechanism in these theories. And finally, we want to use the intuition from orbifold guts to construct heterotic string orbifolds. So that's what I want to discuss, how you do that. So let's discuss in parallel a three-family orbifold gut compactified in a five-dimensional space, which is the Lorentz space across a circle or a line segment, and show how that's related. In fact, the same construction you can get from the heterotic string compactified on two tori mod Z6 plus Wilson lines. And in this talk, I'll just consider an SO10 example, which was given in our paper with Kobayashi and Zhang. Just to remind you, the orbifold in the 5D theory, the orbifold is going to be defined as you can either define as a circle mod, a parity operation, but it's simpler actually to define it as the real line modded by two symmetries. One is a translation symmetry, which defines the circle, so the circle is really the real line modded out by this translation symmetry, and then the parity operation y goes to minus y x here. You can actually think of this as just two parity operations, so sometimes in literature you'll see this as S1 over Z2 cross Z2. The other parity operation is just the combination of the parity y goes to minus y and the translation gives you a new parity operation. This theory has two conjugacy classes of fixed points. This can be gotten by translation. These are equivalent to these, but they're not equivalent to the pi r fixed points. So the integer, even and odd integer fixed points are in two different conjugacy classes of the theory. And we will describe, for example, if you describe this as a fundamental domain going from 0 to pi r, you can talk about fixed points at 0 and fixed points at pi r, and these would be the end of the world fixed points of this five-dimensional space. In terms of a field theory analysis, you would define the fields to be invariant under these parity operations, so the fields have definite parity under y goes to minus y, p goes either plus or minus 1. That parity operation can actually be a subgroup of the gauge group if you want, so you can use that parity operation to break the gauge symmetry down. And as well, you can define a translational symmetry of the fields, but they don't have to come back exactly to themselves. There can also be a gauge twist at the end of the operation, and that would be called the Wilson line. And so you can use this also to break the gauge symmetry down even further. So we'll characterize the fields by their symmetries on the orbifold parities, P and P prime. A general field will have a Kaluza-Klein expansion, and these Kaluza-Klein wave functions can either be even, 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 odd, odd, even, or even, odd, odd under the two parity operations at the end of the world lines. Only the even ones, which means that the wave functions don't vanish either at the zero or pi r fixed points, have massless states. All the others have massive states given by these values. If it's plus here, it means that these wave functions do not vanish at the zero fixed point. If they're minus, they vanish at that zero fixed point. And the opposite here, the even ones don't vanish at the pi r fixed point, but the minus ones are odd under the at the p prime symmetry. So as an example of 5D SO10 orbifold gut, let's imagine that we take the bulk of this theory, we put a vector hypermultiplet in, because in five dimensions, the n equal to 1 supersymmetry in 5D is equivalent to an n equal to 2 supersymmetry in 4D. And so you can think of it as these are 4D superfields, and we have a vector hypermultiplet of the n equal to 2 supersymmetry. The gauge fields live in here. Here's a chiral multiplet in the adjoint representation of SO10. And we'll also put the Higgs hypermultiplet, or a 10 and a 10C, which is the same as a 10, into the bulk. If we do that, we can choose these parity operations in the following way. You see that the parity operation in the even sector preserves an SO10 symmetry. However, on the pi r fixed point, you break the SO10 symmetry down to Patti-Salam. So we can break SO10 down to Patti-Salam with these parity operations. We're going to choose this parity operation to break n equal to 2 to n equal to 1 supersymmetry, so all of these chiral states get mass at that scale. We can also use these parity operations to leave over the Higgs, to do double triplet splitting, and leave over the, get rid of the color triplets and leave only the Higgs doublets as massive states in the theory. Of course, there's all the Kaluza-Klein modes of these fields going from the compactification scale up to some cutoff scale in a 5D orbifold gut. However, if you do this in a string, the cutoff scale is a string scale. It's a physical scale in the theory, but they still have to play with the compactification scale in these theories. And you still get the Kaluza-Klein modes coming out of the string. So this would be the picture of this SO10 orbifold gut. You have these end-of-the-world brains at zero and pi r. We might want to put in these fields in the bulk. In fact, you have to put in these fields in the bulk, these numbers of 6 and 4 hypermultiplets in the bulk. In fact, what you need to satisfy the n equal to 2 or the anomaly cancellation constraints for SO10 in 5 or 6, in 6 dimensions or in a 5-dimensional theory, really don't have anomaly conditions, but this is what you get out of a string, so that's what I'm going to use right now. And here we might want to put the two families of quarks and leptons sitting on the SO10 brain so that we have them in complete multiplets of SO10. Now, how to get this out of the heterotic string? We start out with the EA cross EA heterotic string in 10 dimensions. We compactify 6 dimensions on these product of 3 2-dimensional tori. And this is the kind of toroid we use. This is what Michael was talking about. We have a G2 torus, a lattice, the SU3 lattice, and an SO4 lattice. Notice that I've chosen the string scale, the lengths of these extra dimensions to be of order the string scale, except for this one extra dimension, which I choose to be much larger than the string scale. And this is why I would think of this as in a 5D effective field theory analysis below the string scale. Of course, you're free to choose, these are moduli, and you're free to choose them any way until you figure out how to stabilize these moduli. Then we're going to mod out Z6, Z3, which is equivalent to Z3 cross Mad Wilson lines. And of course, the Z6 is embedded in E8 cross E8 lattice as a shift V6 consistent with modular invariants. So you satisfy all the modular invariance constraints. First, let's consider the torus divided by a Z3 orbifold with a Wilson line in this direction. In these two directions, we can put Wilson lines. The Z3 twist actually only acts on the first two tori and leaves this torus untouched. And as a result of that, after you do the Z3 twist with these Wilson lines, we end up with an effect of either 6 or 5-dimensional theory, depending on how large this extra dimension is, a 5D SO10 theory, where these are the massless states coming out of either the untwisted sector, these and one of these come out of the untwisted sector, and these come out of the twisted sector, where we have two pairs of states living here, here, and here, coming out of the T2 and T4 twisted sector, which I'm showing explicitly in this diagram. So in terms of the orbifold field theory language, all of these states are free to move around, whether they live here or live in the untwisted sector, they're all free to move around on this torus. And so these are bulk states in our orbifold field theory language. Then we have to add a Zid2 orbifold and a Wilson line. The Wilson line we're going to add is going to be in this direction. Okay? And what happens as a result of that, the Z2 and Wilson line, the first parity operation is just given by the Z2 orbifold twist, and we don't break SO10 there, we just break part of the supersymmetry down to n=1 supersymmetry. The second twist associated with the shift vector plus the Wilson line leaves only a Patti-Salam symmetry at this end. And then, therefore, the combined symmetry, the underlying massless states of the theory, which I'm exhibiting here, are just states under Patti-Salam, where this is the gauge sector of Patti-Salam. We get the third family quarks and leptons coming out of the untwisted sector here. We get the other quarks and leptons actually coming out of twisted sector, the T2 and T4 twisted sector, but they're still bulk states in our effective 5D field theory. And we get the Higgs coming out of here. Okay, in this theory, this is one of the models we constructed. We showed that there are no chiral exotics in these theories. We only get vector-like exotics. The vector-like exotics live in several different twisted sectors of the theory. In particular, in this twisted sector of the theory, which is what we call a T1 twisted sector, we get these vector-like exotics. They come as irreducible representations of Patti-Salam, sitting here, 4-4 bar, doublets under SU2 right, under SU2 left, or under SU2 right. And in fact, we even have states which are doublets under a hidden sector SU2 gauge group, which are either doublets under SU2 left or SU2 right. At any rate, we look at the possible coupling, like Michael was discussing, of exotic to anti-exotic coupling to singlets, and we show that we can give, in principle, assuming, we haven't looked at F and D flat directions, but assuming all the singlets can get VEBs, we can give mass to all of these vector-like exotics and decouple them from the theory. But clearly, that's a more detailed question that would have to be go into. And I'm not going to discuss that anymore here, because that's not the subject of this talk. What I really want to talk about here is discrete non-abelian family symmetries coming out of the string. In this twisted sector, we find not only the vector-like exotics, which sit over here, but we got two families of quarks and leptons, one sitting at this fixed point and one sitting at this fixed point. In twisted sector fields, they're localized, as Michael was discussing, on an SO10 fixed point, so they're becoming complete multiplets of SO10. And there's nothing to distinguish these two fixed points because the Wilson line that we put in this direction to break SO10 down to Patti-Salam goes in this direction. So it doesn't distinguish these two different fixed points. So we had this geometry. We have a 16-1 here and a 16-2 here. This is S1 over Z2. And as a result, we get a D4 family symmetry. And the D4 family symmetry can be thought of as this piece coming from the fact that we can interchange those two fixed points. It's just a half shift along the original torus. So this is coming from geometry. The other fixed point comes actually from stringy selection rules, point group or space group selection rules, and we get the fact that we have to have an even number of states leaving at each one of these fixed points, number one, and also we get the fact that this has to be a symmetry. We have to have an even number of states at each one of these fixed points, not at all the fixed points, but also at each one of the fixed points, and this is a space group selection rule. If you take the product of the geometry translation invariance with the space group selection rule, we get a non-abelian symmetry, which is D4, which is just the multiplication of all of these sigma 1, sigma 3. You add it, multiply them all out. It closes on this D4 non-abelian discrete subgroup of SU2, where the first two families which live on those two fixed points transform as a doublet under D4, whereas the third family in the Higgses, in the untwisted sector, transform as singlets under the D4 family symmetry. Now, it's nice to have family symmetries or flavor symmetries in your theory, especially in supersymmetric theories. One thing is that you can use these family symmetries to try to generate, when you break these family symmetries, to try to generate a hierarchy of fermion masses. How does that work? Well, the third family is a singlet, so therefore, naturally, and the Higgs is a singlet, so you naturally can have a coupling at tree level for the third family to the Higgs, but you can't have any couplings at tree level of the other families to the Higgs, so therefore you have to get them via effective higher dimension operators, which you always have in string theories. And then how they come in, what kind of structure you have for the Yukawa matrices, and this is just an example of what structure you might have. It's not to be realistic in any way. The kind of structure that you have for the Yukawa matrix is then fixed by the D4, in this case, D4 family symmetry. And when you break the D4 family symmetry down, you can then generate masses for the first and second families of quarks and leptons. In addition, it's nice to have these flavor symmetries because a non-abelian family symmetry that you have in a supersymmetric theory also acts on the scalars in your supersymmetric theory. And therefore, at the level of symmetry, in other words, if you have D4 invariance and you break supersymmetry and that supersymmetry doesn't break that D4 symmetry, then your scalars, for example, in this case, in the first two generations, have to have degenerate masses consistent with the D4 family symmetry. So they have equal masses. And now when you break the D4 family symmetry, the scalar mass matrix may get off-diagonal terms, but it's going to be lined with the fermion mass matrices. And so you can suppress flavor violation using these flavor symmetries, even discrete non-abelian flavor symmetries. So that's why you might want to have them in your effective low energy theory. Okay, so let's go to the second part of this talk. We're going to discuss these stringy selection rules and discrete family flavor symmetries that you might get out in different orbifold constructions. This is what Michael alluded to, all the possible orbifolds that you're allowed to do on the string and preserve n equal to 1 supersymmetry. So this is just a table of all the twists that you can make. The one that we were using was a Z2 cross Z3 twist, which is appearing here. But there's lots of other possibilities. In fact, the Z2 cross Z3 is equivalent to this Z6-2, okay? But we want to study other different possibilities, and so that's what I'm going to do now. Let's make the language a little bit more specific now. The torus is going to be defined as the fact that we have, say, a six-dimensional space where we have a shift invariance with these lattice vectors, and n's are integers. Okay, so we allow for this shift invariance defines the torus. So we have a d-dimensional torus, which is the Riemann space in d dimensions divided out by these lattice vectors. We then orbifold this by defining twists on which are symmetries of the lattice. So we have to choose the lattice appropriate for the kinds of twists that we're looking at. And in this case, I'm just giving you an example of a Zn orbifold where theta, the twist vector, has to satisfy theta to the nth power is equal to 1. And then this defines the Td over Zn orbifold. The fields which we might be interested in, either the untwisted sector or the twisted sector fixed points, or twisted sector fields live at these fixed points, and the fixed points are defined in the kth twisted sector by satisfying this relationship, that a fixed point is a fixed point only if you say that it goes back to itself up to a lattice vector shift. Okay, so f is equal to kf plus any lattice vector, particular lattice vector shift. Of course, f itself is only defined up to a lattice vector shift itself, and so this equation is equivalent to this equation that says that 1 minus theta kf has to be living in one of these sublattices of the original lattice that defined the orbifold, and this defines the conjugacy classes of the lattice. So in our original case, we have the even set of conjugacy classes or the odd set of conjugacy classes because this lattice is only defined up to twice a lattice vector. Okay, as in a different example, let's look at a T2 over Z3 orbifold. There's one of the cases that we looked at in this paper, which is unpublished but is in preparation. If we ask what is the conjugacy classes of this Z3 orbifold, we find out that 1 minus, this is in fact a SU3 lattice that we can use to define a Z3 orbifold. And we look at the conjugacy classes and we see that this sublattice is spanned by the vectors 3 times E1, which is the vector in this direction, and any number of E2 minus E1s, which are vectors in this direction. And so, in fact, there are three inequivalent fixed points which we can label by the space group operation, which would act on this fixed point and take it back to itself after you make the orbifold transformation. For example, this point here is theta 0 because you don't have to do any translations to get back to that fixed point. This fixed point under a Z3 orbifold rotation, we come back, we'll come over to here, and in fact, this can be gotten by a shift in this direction, 1 by 1 unit, plus using any number of these, we can get back down to here. So this would be the state, this state here was the one that's invariant, the fixed point, and this is the state labeled by theta and E1, and this is a state labeled by theta and 2E1. So these are the three different non-equivalent fixed points in this T2 over Z3 orbifold. And the question is what is the symmetry group of the system if we happen to have fields living at these three different fixed points? To discuss the symmetry group, we have to discuss the stringy selection rules, and the stringy selection rules are simply gotten, the space group selection rules are simply gotten by looking at the product of these three representations of the fixed points, theta and M1 EI, where I labels which fixed point state we're talking about, and we can take the product of these up to from 1 to n, which we would get from looking at n vertex operators in the vacuum, and what we have to satisfy is that this product is equal to the identity shift. And the identity shift is defined as being nothing, no theta to the 0, up to being one of these conjugacy classes of the sublattice. When you take this product, you get something that looks like this. So you get theta to the n, this is just the product of space group elements, you get theta to the n, and then the sum on I of M1 I E1 in this particular case. And as a result of that, we get two different types of selection rules. We get that n has to be a multiple of 3. That would be what's called a point group selection rule. And we also get that these MIs have to sum up to 3, 0 mod 3. And that would satisfy these selection rules. So these are what I call the space group selection rules. If we try to think how they would act on the fields in a superpotential, the first one, the fact that the product has to be equal to n equals 3, says that we have a Z3 symmetry where W is just e to the 2 pi I over 3, and the fields have to be Z3, and the all vertices have to be Z3 invariant. The second one, the space group selection rule, says that we can identify with the field E1 a factor of omega, and the field 2E1 a factor of omega squared, and this would guarantee that if we say that omega only states which are invariant under this symmetry are allowed, would be equivalent to saying that the sum on MI is equal to 0 mod 3. Finally, we have the selection rule which would come from the permutation symmetry, the S3 permutation symmetry of this three-dimensional object. There's an S3 symmetry if we look at it, just because of the fact that we can take this point into this point and this point under the translations of the lattice, or we can make a symmetry operation, a reflection symmetry, which we interchange these two points. So there's a complete S3 permutation symmetry of these three fixed points. You can't distinguish them as long as there's no Wilson lines in the extra dimensions. Putting that all together, we get these three different discrete symmetries, but if you take the products of these symmetries now, what you get is what symmetry called delta 54, which is the union or the product of all of these symmetries, the S3, with these two Z3 symmetries. So the symmetry of these three fixed points is a delta 54 symmetry. Once we have a delta 54 symmetry, you might ask, can we do spontaneous symmetry breaking? What happens if the field that sits here gets a vacuum expectation value? One of the fields might be a singlet under SO10 or a singlet under the standard model, but it can sit here and get a non-zero vacuum expectation value. If it did that, it would break the symmetry clearly. And what it breaks it down to is D3, where these two states transform as a doublet under the D3 family symmetry. So we can have symmetry breaking down to a smaller symmetry group, where now, you know, for example, we could have used this to give the third family a mass, and then we're left with the two light families, which transform as a doublet under the D3 family symmetry. other possibilities. Let me just look at a different orbifold. And if we have the orbifold, which is a general lattice, it always has a Z2 where you can make a 180-degree rotation around this two-dimensional surface, then we can show that we have a D4 cross D4 family symmetry divided by Z2, where one D4 essentially acts in this direction, and the other D4 acts in this direction, and the combined, if we just had D4 cross D4, we might think of these two states living as being doublets under both D4, so we have a 2,2 representation of D4 cross D4. However, we show that the two D4s have a common Z2 symmetry, which we have to mod out, and we only have the symmetry of all of these four states act as a fourplet under the D4 cross D4 divided by Z2 symmetry group. Another example, let's look at T2 over Z4 orbifold. And in fact, let's just look at the theta twisted sector, the first twisted sector in this theory. If we take a torus, in fact, a torus defined by equal lengths, so it's a square, and mod it out by a Z4 symmetry, we just get two fixed points of the torus. And in fact, this is the two twisted sector states, theta 0 and theta E1. And to be very quick, they transform as doublet under a D4 family symmetry. If we look at the theta squared twisted sector, we find out that there are four states in the theta squared twisted sector because the theta squared twisted sector is T2 over Z2. So there's four states which are labeled by the theta squared, E0, E1, E2, and E1 plus E2 in this twisted sector. And they are a fourplet under that symmetry group, D4 cross D4 over Z2. Question is, what happens when you combine, when you have interactions which couple the first twisted sector to the second twisted sector? Well, then the maximal symmetry that you can get is the symmetry of the smallest symmetry that you can possibly have. And then you can ask, well, how do these four states transform under this symmetry group? And in fact, the way they transform is four singlets under the symmetry group. So under this symmetry group now, the selection rules give us four singlets and a doublet when we combine these two sectors. It's like the standard model. The Higgs sector of the theory has a larger symmetry than the symmetry of the standard model. The Higgs sector of the theory has an SO4 symmetry, whereas the standard model putting together all the interactions only has SU2 left cross U1 hypercharge symmetry. So here we can have sectors which have a larger symmetry than the combined theory. One more example, and I'll be finished. Let's look at the T2 over Z2 orbifold, in particular putting it on an SU3 lattice. If we put it on an SU3 lattice, then this orbifold has actually been discussed by Altarelli, Ferruglio, and Lin, and we identify all the points, and this torus is equivalent, or this orbifold is equivalent to this tetrahedron. And we might ask, what is the symmetry of the tetrahedron? Well, these are the two symmetry operations, geometric symmetries of the tetrahedron, which gives us an A4 symmetry, which has cubic, the highest irreducible representation is a triplet. But in fact, there was something mixed in this paper by in this upcoming paper by Altarelli, Ferruglio, and Lin, and because there's an additional symmetry, a reflection symmetry, which would take this point, say, into this point, and you can't do that by just a geometrical rotation of a tetrahedron. It's not a global symmetry of the tetrahedron, but it's certainly a symmetry of this torus. Make a reflection symmetry about this point, which just interchanges these two points on the tetrahedron. That converts the A4 symmetry into an S4 symmetry, complete permutation symmetry of all the points in the tetrahedron. And so this is the complete symmetry of this system. And so I'll end here by saying this table or something like it will appear in our paper to describe the symmetries of these building blocks that we've discussed of heterotic string models. So the conclusion is we have non-abelian flavor symmetries. We spontaneously break those flavor symmetries. We can generate a fermion mass hierarchy, so they're good for that. They're good for suppressing flavor-violating processes. Orbifolds give us discrete non-abelian flavor symmetries by a combination of point group selection rules and geometry. And the goal is to find a realistic models using these tools. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, in the realistic models, you have to turn on Wilson lines, and they will break the...
That's another way to break the symmetry, sure.
They break the symmetries, and they will break them at the scale of the string scale. So you have to look for the remaining non-abelian symmetries after the Wilson lines.
Absolutely. So in that SR10 example, we put a Wilson line in one direction. We could have put a Wilson line in both directions and broken that that D4 symmetry. But if we only put a Wilson line in one direction, we preserve the D4, just the D4 symmetry, not the full D4 cross D4 symmetry.
Right, okay. And also when you want to break the group to the standard model group, you have to give depth to all the singlets, and the singlets will also be charged. Will break also the non-abelian symmetries, huh?
You can, with the breaking that we're doing down, there is...
To build the standard model, like you want to... You have all this extra vector, like particles and so on, so you have to...
You're asking a question in a detailed model, what symmetries would we have left over? We'll have to construct a detailed model and tell.
Okay.
Other questions?
Yeah, in the attempts by Nier and Seiberg and their collaborators to explain mass matrices in terms of abelian flavor symmetries, when they talked about this mechanism of alignment that you referred to, they generally found that with current data, those models don't work, that there are problems with DD bar mixing and things like that. So do you have an understanding? So that I believe the only models of those types that work are ones that where they really get degenerate.
DS mixing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, in order to suppress that sufficiently, I would claim that you even with this suppression, you still have to raise the scalar masses up to about 2 TeV or so.
Oh, I see.
And then you can live with it.
Well, family symmetry, and in this class of model, when we study the flavor changing processes, it is able to keep it under control.
For any value of scalar masses, or you still have to have heavier scalar masses?
No, for relatively light scalar masses. It should be said that the mu t gamma is very close to the limits, but it is below it.
If there's no questions,
so before we stop, we have to remind you that at 2:15 this afternoon, the seminar is by Bobby Acharya, just to recall.
Okay, start. I have one comment about this discrete symmetry. You studied non-abelian discrete symmetries. We have studied abelian discrete symmetries, and in G12, there are some terms, this can be used to introduce global symmetry, approximate global symmetry, and this is very useful for actions from superstring, but not from PMN field. It is coming from matter moduli, and we are calculating for the first time action photon coupling from superstring. Okay, thank you.